the one thing that a lot of us can agree on is that in marketing technology, the companies that are trying to do everything are not really doing anything well.
This is Superfast Business with James Schramko.
James Schramko.
Helping you build your business super fast.
All right, so Clay Collins is on the line and I'm recording. G'day, mate.
Hey, James, it's been forever. Good to be talking with you.
You know what? It was May 2014 we last recorded our series where we'd spoken many times prior to that, and we had a failed attempt in between to catch up last year. But a lot's been happening since you had 55 employees in your business.
Yeah, like a ton. So we're now over 40,000 active customers. We're over 150 people. We've raised over $35 million in venture capital. We've raised $38 million in venture capital. We hosted our first conference. Yeah, just lots of stuff has happened.
I'd love to just sort of chat to you about some of the things that have been going on, in that last growth phase, because I'm really doing my best to document this stratospheric rise. I mean, I was there right at the beginning, even before you had your current product name. So it's been interesting to watch. Do you mind if I ask you a couple of questions and you can, choose how you want to answer them? Some of them mightn't be pleasant, but I think they're really interesting for our listeners.
Absolutely. Let's do it.
First off, a lot of people, when they're choosing domains, they say, what should I get? And I often say, look, get a .com. And sometimes they point to lead pages having a .net. Has that been a problem?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I don't think it's been – like, I'm glad we moved quickly. So when we were going to get a name, we wanted leadpages.com. That person really wasn't communicating – the person who owned that domain really wasn't communicating with us. And I felt strongly about the name, and I felt strongly that we didn't, we shouldn't do leadpages.co or, leadpages.app.com or something like that. So I felt strongly about the name, and I felt strongly that, that the most important thing was the name. So if you look at companies like Tesla Motors, or actually it's just Tesla, right? But Tesla is at teslamotors.com. No one calls them Tesla Motors. They're just Tesla, right? And then you have, you have lots of companies like that. Square, for example, that makes the payment processing device. They recently IPO. Jack Dorsey's their CEO. He's now the dual CEO of Square and Twitter. Square is at squareup.com. And so I think from a branding perspective, the name of your organization is first and foremost. And if you can't get the .com, then if you get large enough, you will eventually be able to purchase it. I think what happened for us is by the time that we had the success and the cash where we could purchase it, we decided that if we were going to spend that kind of money, we might as well get a single word .com, highly brandable name, and so we got center.com, and we're sort of in the final stages of making that that happen, but we have signed contracts, and the current owners are phasing it off of their system and giving it to us. So I think honestly the whole thing went down in a way that was somewhat unfortunate for the owner of leadpages.com. They could have made quite a bit, but frankly, we're not really willing to negotiate with us.
Right. So in summary, you're saying it's good to have a .com if you can get it, and the longer you wait to buy it, the more expensive it will probably become to acquire it, but the more likely you are to be able to afford it. And ideally, you just get a killer brandable .com as the ultimate.
Ideally, I think at the end of the day, though, you shouldn't let the availability of a domain affect your brand decision. I think brand is probably first and foremost, and there's lots of options now. There's .co, there's .io, which is kind of interesting.
And this is different to trademark, right?
Yeah, I mean, you generally don't trademark the domain name, right? So the exception back in the day when .coms were rare was like drugstore.com and like diapers.com. There were all these .coms. And from a trademark perspective, and I'm not an attorney, can't give legal advice, all that, people can't really append those domain names to their trademarks anymore. So it's just like whatever the brand is. And of course, you need to talk with a trademark attorney. When you're a startup, exactly, you don't have time for any of that. And the longer you operate with a name, at least here in the US, the longer you operate with a name uncontested, the less likely someone could be to take it from you.
Well, I've had the situation where someone can't take it from me, but they can set up, you know, on a similar thing in a different region and start sort of swamping the search results and making it inconvenient for you. So I think I like the sort of idea of setting a trigger point. When you get to a certain point, that's when you trigger things like ownership and, you know, branding decisions that will have a big impact on your business for the long haul. But I think in your case, you got so big and so strong that whatever domain you had was going to be irrelevant by this point now. But the new one that you've got, the first thing I said when I heard about this name was, what a great name. It says what it is too.
Yeah, we like it. We like it quite a bit. And so, you know, we should be rolling that over to center.com, you know, for this product, not for the entire brand, but for this product, we should be rolling that over like mid-February.
In the last year and somewhere in, you know, in between 55 and 150 people, you kind of got hard to get to and gobbled up by the whole machine there somehow. And then you popped back out and did a blog post, and here we are updating the mini series. Can you tell me about what happened? You know, was it like a three-wave hold down when you're surfing a big wave, point break, or like what's the last year been like for Clay?
Yeah, I didn't know that I was hard to get to. I certainly wasn't posting a lot on social media. I wasn't speaking at events, but I think a lot of things happened. You know, I think that honestly, while perhaps the hardest thing that I've ever done in my career, you know, sort of the first year and a half of a software company is really a lot easier than the second year and a half. Yeah. Starting things, I think, is really easy for marketers. And you live in this world where there's no technical debt around your product. You know, you don't have infrastructure issues. You don't have scaling issues. And there's sort of this logarithmic sort of relationship between the number of engineers you have and how quickly you can put out products. In other words, you know, getting out an initial version of Lead Pages, four developers were essentially creating the core of that product up until like a year and a half. And then after that, we added a whole bunch of other people, essentially taking our, you know, our product and engineering teams to literally over 60 people. And what most people saw was the same. And that was because we were, you know, we had learned from the first year and a half, we had money, cash flow, and a customer base. And we were like, well, now that we know all this, what do we really want to build? And I guess what I mean is more like, how do you really want to build it rather than what, because we know what we want to build.
So basically a lot of the original restrictions that a normal business would have been lifted. You've got an audience, you've got a, you know, that user base, you've got money. Yeah. And now it's like turns into more of the creative strategic pursuit, right?
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot more strategic.
And what tools do you use, or what processes do you have to decide? Is it just what Clay's vision is when he jumps out of bed in the morning? Is it Iggy Kai? Is it something else?
Yeah, so great question. You know, there's lots of frameworks around this. There's something called a one-page strategic plan, which is kind of outlined in a book called Scaling Up. I think that's a good exercise to go through. There's something that I think actually isn't very well known in the internet marketing space, but is really well respected outside of it. And it's called pragmatic marketing. And so there's a series of sort of pragmatic marketing courses, and they go through frameworks on market-driven development. And so I think when you're a small company, everyone kind of gets the vision. There's lots of access to the founders. Everyone's talking all the time. And as you get larger, everyone kind of needs the vision explained in a much more systematic way. So what's the theme for the year? What are the top four goals? And how do we translate from this high-level vision that I might have all the way to, you know, what an individual in product or an individual in marketing or an individual in sales, you know, how do they line up, you know, what they're doing with the department goal, with the company goal? And that's just, this is just like the hard part of building a company. And so 2015 was freaking hard. We doubled again as a business, which was nice, but there was a lot of things that felt like, you know, they just needed to be cleaned up after, you know, a couple years of hyper growth. You know, there was a lot of dust in the closets. And so I was not very visible. And I was back with the rest of my team, just cleaning out closets, just, you know, working on foundations. And that's really what I was doing. And it was hard work and it was frustrating work. And, you know, I love launching new things. This was 2015 was not the year of not launching new things.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised this point of clearing out the closet and building up dust. I'm in this constant process of pruning and refining and simplifying and stripping back, because as someone who's a prolific creator, and a lot of entrepreneurs are, we go out and register all these domains, these websites, we start different business divisions, we've got this trail of stuff, and it's really expensive to clean up. And people, when they're buying a domain for $9 at 2 in the morning, they're not thinking about that, A, they're going to have to renew this for the next 6 years while it's sitting there gathering dust, but also at some point in the future, they've committed to having to sit down, look at that domain, make a decision to kill it or grow it or sell it or whatever, and then, you know, get rid of it. So we can collect and grab too many things. So I guess as you've emerged with this new direction that you're taking, I guess getting rid of things and making decisions on what to kill off or stop or not put focus onto is just as important as what you decide to focus on.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that if you are a five-person business, it's really easy to have three brands. I think if you're a 150-person business, it is incredibly hard to have even two brands, you know, because the more people you have involved, you know, the more you have to systematize. That systemization takes just a whole lot of overhead and work, and it's necessary and it's good. But I actually think you can do less in terms of spinning off new projects the larger you get. And I think that's it's a good thing, actually. And I think it keeps you focused on what matters. So yeah, it's been less about eliminating things, and it's been more about cleaning up and creating structures and processes around what we already had, and around creating structures and processes for the future. Like we're starting on 2016 here, and we actually have like a 2016 strategic plan with a budget that lines up to it, with a projected P&L that lines up to that, with sort of headcount that lines up under those things. And then that's derived from, you know, the annual goals. And it's like, it's rigorous stuff. It's next level stuff. It's stuff that I think most people, or at least a lot of people that get started, like they never aspire to do this. They never want to do this. And that's okay.
Well, it's hard work, isn't it?
It's freaking hard work. Like this is 2015 has been probably, you know, in terms of pushing myself to the next level, it's been the hardest year. So here's what I think the life of a CEO is, of a fast growing startup. So you spend about 6 months doing an okay job at what you do. And then you spend about 3 months realizing that your job has fundamentally changed, that you have a completely new job now, even though the title's the same. And then you spend about 3 months doing everything you can to learn your new job. And then you spend 6 months being okay at that until you realize, you know, that your job has changed all over again and you have to relearn a new set of skills. And so, you know, 2015 really was the year of like learning a new job for me. And it's one of the most humbling experiences for me, but it's also been a really beautiful, fantastic one. And I'm glad that I got to be a part of it. And I think that's what you get when you work for a startup, is you get to see your job change over and over and over again. What would take people sort of four or five careers to accomplish, you know, they get to do in a much more compressed time span.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I used to think when I was progressing through sales and sales management, general management, I was working like 5 years to everyone else's one. I wasn't doing the same year over each year. I was starting a whole new chapter, reading another bunch of books, implementing new things. I was going to ask you about your emotional changes, but you've partially answered that. Where do you draw from as a busy CEO with all this funding and huge responsibility and 40,000 active subscribers? Where does Clay Collins go to for good information as a CEO? Where do you draw from?
You know, I think the bigger we get, the more I find myself drawing from the C-level talent in our organization and also our senior leadership team. So, you know, books are good and systems are good, but at some point you've just like consumed enough information that more information like isn't going to really move the needle substantially in your life. And it's at those times having people in your business on a day-to-day basis who have battle scars, who have had ups and downs in other businesses, that can that sort of know you, and they know the business, and they know that phase of the business. And I think they can counsel you often in ways that, like, you're just never going to get there that fast with additional information.
So where do you get those people? Are they masterminds? I remember when you got funding, you told me that you didn't really need the money, but you wanted the contacts. Did that pan out to be the case in hindsight, or did you end up needing the money as well?
You know, so no, we have started spending a little bit of the money. We've raised 38, and our Series A was $5 million. So we just kind of started tapping into that Series A money. So the contacts there have been a lot of contacts. For example, you know, someone I'm speaking to right now, was the CFO of Oracle at one point and was on the, is on the board of Priceline. That person has had just like tremendous advice. I'm wondering if I'm supposed to say his name or not. I probably shouldn't.
Just don't. And then
I mean, that person came through a VC recommendation. I think the VCs themselves have been the most sort of provided the greatest amount of advice. So one of our venture capitalists was, they own 30% of Fitbit when Fitbit IPO'd at like a $5 billion valuation. So they own like 30% of Fitbit. And so they had seen every single phase of that business's growth and every single phase of like Moz's growth and every single phase of like Zynga's growth. And so when you're sitting on the boards of these companies, there's sort of day-to-day management, and then there's board-level governance around hiring C-level people, managing plans, making sure that your legal stuff is kind of in a row. There's just – so it's been absolutely one of the best things that I think we've done. And not everyone has had the same experience. You know, when people say, should we raise venture capital, I always say like, well, like, should you get married? Like, it just really depends a lot on who the other person in the relationship is. And for us, it's been absolutely fantastic. So another person who invested in us is a person named Doug Burgum. So Doug Burgum is the chairperson of Atlassian, which is an Australian company, which just IPO'd. I believe, they're trading it at a valuation of $6 billion. And so he's like the third time he's done that kind of thing. So there's been a lot of really good advice that has come from that. So it was absolutely worth it. I would absolutely do it again. So no regrets there whatsoever.
How do you think bigger? I'm sure you must get to a point where you think, oh gosh, other people think more of me than even I do sometimes.
And absolutely.
Aside from guys like me telling you that you're always going to be successful, which is so easy to say now in hindsight, but I said it beforehand, which is lucky. who else is in your cheerleading squad?
Yeah. So in terms of pushing me to think bigger, I think Doug Burgum, the person I mentioned, pushes me to think bigger. There's a guy here locally. He's a CEO of a company called Code 42. Which is just crushing it. He pushes me to think bigger. And then, of course, when I read books like the Elon Musk book, it's like, okay, like we're making, marketing software for crying out loud. And he's putting people on the moon.
He's doing spaceships and, electronic cars.
Yeah, while he's building out Tesla. So, it's like in the scheme of things. Eh.
So you're really using benchmarking and social references.
I think so. Yeah, that makes sense.
That's good. Clay, what about when you do blog posts, how much do you feel you're posting for the customer and how much do you feel you're posting for the investor?
Oh, I don't know that we're posting for the investor almost ever. I can't, when we did the center launch, that was all for the customer. Yeah, that's a great question. I honestly... truly, authentically can't recall a single blog post that I think we posted for the investor.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Are you thinking of a specific post or?
Yeah. You the one you sort of posted after not being posting for a while, and it was lengthy and explained Center. It was a big announcement.
Yeah.
There were some whispers in the hallways. Oh, this is designed for the investors to be confident about the company. But I thought, you know what? I'm going to ask Clay straight up because Clay wrote the post, presumably. And it's just, I think when you get a lot of funding, it would be interesting to see how long it takes to turn from a party one into Darth Vader. And in your case, it sounds like you're still with the Force.
Yeah, I think, you know, like if so, so whatever post that was, which I think was speaking at a somewhat high, you know, at a somewhat high level, but I also think it was speaking like to our market. So if you read the comments of those posts, I would say people got it. So, you know, if we had a certain type of person posting in there and the customer base just wasn't getting it at all, or our market wasn't getting it, I think that would be something extremely different. But like, read the comments on there and see who fundamentally commented and who that message fundamentally resonated with.
No, I got it. I thought it was very clear cut, and you posted it. You know, it wasn't someone in the PR department, et cetera. It's great. And yeah. I mean, you've gone from this kid making videos under his staircase to, you know, a very public, high profile CEO. So that's what I like about this journey, and as the story unfolds, you know, we're tracking it. What have you learnt about ownership structure and equity and things? Is there anything you'd changed? Have you found yourself in a weird situation with, you know, over giving or under contributing, or, you know, because partnerships are common discussion amongst you know, businesses, and I think you had a couple of partners or co-founders. How's all those relationships going? Is it like that movie with Dustin and Mark Zuckerberg? Is it changing the relationship between partners, or are you all still cozy?
Yeah, I'd say we're cozy. So, you know, the company started with Tracy and myself. We have a technical co-founder who lives in Prague. And I'd say, you know, to the best of my knowledge, everything's actually really good. Tracy and I still talk on a regular basis. And Simon, who was the third co-founder, is part of our engineering organization. And so, unfortunately, I don't get to communicate with him as much, because I'm speaking more with our VP of product delivery. But he's still with the company, and things are good. So as far as I know, there's no crazy breakups, and Tracy and I are as strong as ever. And Simon and I, unfortunately, don't get to talk as much as we used to. But there's no weirdness there. It isn't part of kind of our day to day sort of operational patterns to talk. But you know, every once in a while, he'll come to the U.S. and we'll hang out and grab a beer and reminisce about the old days.
As a company, you've been pretty strong on having people work in your hometown. How's that? Yeah. Has that been a good strategy instead of going sort of a remote path?
Yeah. You know, so we have remote employees. I'm really grateful for them. And, you know, and it's been, they've added a ton. And I'm really glad that we have a local culture that, you know, when we're talking about difficult product decisions, we can do that in a room together. We can look each other in the eye. We can run up to the whiteboard and we can collaborate. And like, I do not care how much people say, well, there's GoToWebinar and there's Skype and there's Voxer and there's like this and there's Slack. Like, I think you get probably 10 to 20% more bandwidth when you're collaborating in real time. So we have a situation where people can work from home 2 days a week and then we're in the office 3 days a week. And I think that's a fantastic balance. In my mind, there's absolutely zero chance that we would have grown as big as we are, as fast as we are, had the level of success that we've had as a virtual business. There's just a level at which that stops working. And I think that's probably at around, you know, 30 people, really, in a engineering-driven culture.
Yeah, I can totally see that. It's great to see that people do that. I've seen other companies be successful bringing in a culture, whether it's Microsoft or Google. That's good. What have you learned about the subscription business model? That's a really great topic for our clients at Superfast Business. I know, I think originally some of your products were one-time purchases or even free, and you've gone to a subscription business model. Any sidesteps that you would do differently, or things that are vital for someone to consider if they're a software as a service subscription business?
You know, I think that software subscription business, or just the subscription business in general, is it is its own thing. And people might think they know that space. I thought I knew that space, but I did not know that business model like I do now. And there's just a whole lot of stuff there. So, you know, what happens is when you first start out, you're adding customers extremely fast, or, you know, we still are. And, you know, obviously people churn out of that subscriber base. So let's say hypothetically, you know, you have a 3% monthly churn. So you're losing on any given month, you're losing 3% of your customer base. Well, you know, when you have 100,000, when you have 100,000 customers, that 3% is 3,000 people, which means you need to, at a minimum, add 3,000 people to your business just to break even, right? And then if you want to grow 3%, you have to be adding 6,000 people per month, like new customers to your business to get even a 3% month over month growth. So the law of large numbers really kicks in. And I think the problem that a lot of membership site owners have and people who just kind of are operating at, you know, at sort of like sub 10,000 customers, or, you know, probably around 10,000 customers, is that growing that subscription business seems easy, but at a larger scale, there's things that come up. And so I think that if your ambition is to get 100,000 subscribers, 200,000 subscribers, then you should be investing in retention as much or more as you're investing in marketing. And I see most companies doing the opposite. Is, you know, maybe they'll have a 10-person marketing team and they'll have like 2 people on retention. And it's like, well, you need like 15 people in retention and 10 people in marketing.
And I guess in your case, coders could be considered part of the retention. If you're making great product that people, you know, just have to have, that'd be a great retention strategy too.
Yeah, I think, you know, at the end of the day, everyone's retention. And so even marketers are retention. Like, are they acquiring customers? Like, if you have $100,000 in ad spend to spend for Group A that churns at a high rate, or you could spend it on Group B that churns at a much lower rate, you should be spending it on Group B, right? Product should be making sure that sort of onboarding flows are there. Support should be doing everything they can to proactively help the customer before they get frustrated and want to leave. You know, product and engineering should be aligning around it. So retention is absolutely everyone's job. It's not the kind of thing that you can just like, you know, I've heard this expression before, we don't use it at LeadPages, but it's not the kind of thing where you can just like throw bodies at, like, these two people are going to be doing retention. Like, what the heck does that mean?
Yeah, exactly. I'm glad you sort of you're tipping into the cool stuff, you know, like predictive analysis and cohorts. These are things that you're going to be thinking about. I mean, if you take your example of 100,000 subscriber base and you're losing, 3,000 a month, and if your average product was, you know, just even if your lifetime value was only $100, that's a lot of money to be losing. If you could plug the hole in the bucket, that's great. And I'm so glad you mentioned it. A lot of the efforts that I put into my coaching students is fixing up their at least their unsubscribe sequence. When people leave, we've got to find out why and start putting that back into the system and see if you can get them back, and then we work back from there. How do we stop them from leaving the first place?
Yeah. And I mean, another thing that I think is really incredibly valid is, you know, was I selling a product to someone who has no business buying this kind of product in the first place? Or
exactly. Framing and expectations. Yep. And message to market match. Did they buy it because they got a free iPad, or they had a chance of one, or did they buy it because they really need to be able to capture someone's email address on their landing page?
Yeah, it's an incredible point. And I think that, you know, a lot of people kind of do this stuff, and I think it happens in the info product space where it's like you could do everything in the world and you just are not going to retain this person because this was an opportunity seeker who is going to be buying a bunch of products right now, and they're going to have the same success with them that they had with the last 10 products that they bought, which is the same success they had with their New Year's resolution, which is the same success they had, you know, with the treadmill that they bought, and that is like nothing. And so if you are seductive to the kind of person who is not likely to actually succeed, then your business model flaw goes a lot deeper than just sort of this abstract notion of retention and onboarding sequences and framing. Like, you have a long-term business problem there. And that's something that's like really hard to recover from, So that's another issue.
That's awesome. And I've only got two questions I just want to close out with, Clay. You've been very generous so far with sharing your answers. I'm deliberately choosing some questions that you may not have answered before, or certainly not publicly, that I think people would be really fascinated with. Now, tell me about the live conference. How did that go, and is it something you'll continue to do?
Yeah, it was a fantastic event. So we had 500 people there. It was a packed house. We want to double next year. We will absolutely do that again. We're planning next year's live event right now. So, it's at converted.com. So we did converted 2015, and we'll be doing converted 2016. And the goal with this was not to create some pitch from the stage. We didn't pitch anything from the stage at all. The purpose of that was to build an industry conference and to build value. And I'm really, really happy with the initial version. It's probably like the best first conference that, and I'm biased, of course, but it's probably the best first conference that I've ever seen a company do. I'm really proud of how it turned out. I'm really proud of Julie and our marketing team. And we're absolutely in for round two.
That's fantastic. So just in closing, each time I've spoken to you, you've always been sort of busting out of your skin about something that's around the corner, something you're so excited about that you can just hear it coming through. What is Clay Collins excited about right now at this point? We're at the beginning of 2016. What have we got to look forward to?
Yeah, so one huge thing that I'm looking forward to is Center. So center.com, which is a marketing command center. And you basically plug in all the integrations that you're using, and you can run marketing campaigns across all of them. So what we're finding is that people are using more and more tools. Sort of, they're using a smaller percentage of the available feature set of their all-in-one marketing platform, and instead using a whole bunch of point solutions. The problem is that it's hard to sort of run a coordinated marketing campaign with a bunch of one-off point solutions. And that's what Center is for. You can do things like say, hey, if someone watches 50% of this Wistia video and they attended the last webinar, if they visit the pricing page but don't check out, then send them a text message. Or hey, if someone, let's say someone attended a webinar but only watched 5% of it, then pass that through to HubSpot unless they've, done this other activity on the website, in which case send them to Salesforce as a sales lead. You can do like all kinds of things like that. And so it's kind of a sort of automating across your existing tools rather than taking the approach of trying to build everything. And I think that the one thing that a lot of us can agree on is that in marketing technology, the companies that are trying to do everything are not really doing anything well. So there are companies that'll do your shopping cart and your affiliate system and your email and your automation and your landing pages and your analytics, blah, blah, blah. And what we're finding is that people are still subscribing to those things, and many of those are good tools, but they're using Stripe for their payments, and they're using like SamCart for their shopping cart, and they're using like SendGrid or Mandrill for their transactional emails, and they're using like HasOffers or Cake for their affiliate system, and they're using like us for their landing pages, and they're using Mixpanel or Google Analytics for their analytics. And so there's sort of this a lot of fragmentation happening. And so we want to be the command center that you plug everything into, and basically an open marketing automation tool. So a tool like Marketo or HubSpot might be a closed system. So you can automate across signals that, for example, Marketo is getting. If Marketo knows you visited this page, and if Marketo built the landing page, and if Marketo sent you the email, then you can create automation rules based on that. But if you have like eight different tools that you're plugged into, you can't sort of automate at that level anymore. So that's what Center's for. So that's one thing I'm really excited about. The second thing that we're excited about is we're releasing our drag and drop builder. And this is something that people have been asking for a long, long time, literally since we launched Lead Pages. And honestly, the reason why we did it was because we looked at the available technology. We didn't think anyone was doing it right, and we didn't think the technology was there. And sort of middle of, beginning of Q2 last year, two things happened. Angular 2 was sort of in early alpha stage, which is a JavaScript framework, and also something called Aurelia was also in early stage. And we looked at that, those JavaScript frameworks, and we said, finally, there's a possibility to create, to do a good job, not a crappy job, but a good job of what people have been asking for us, from us all along. And we commenced creating our drag and drop, super flexible, mobile responsive landing page builder. And I'll tell you, I've played with Squarespace, I've played with Wix, I've played with Weebly, I've played with all the tools out there. And I think what people are going to find is something that's actually better than a Wix or Weebly or Squarespace, but yet is made from the ground up for conversion like Lead Pages currently exist today. And I think that this is one of the areas where we've leapfrogged everyone else probably a good 3 years. And there's literally 15 full-time people working on that project. It's sort of the best crafted thing I've seen us ever create. And I'm really excited about people getting that.
So you do feel that you're able to cover such a huge undertaking like that. Like it's like a mega all-in-one Swiss Army knife. So it's going to require a lot of APIs and integrations and constant updates, which I know you had a lot of experience with your first product, with the Lead Player product, constantly YouTube changing their coding, etc. So that, you know, it's a huge undertaking. I imagine you're going to need lots of coding, and it's going to be a substantial project, but also a market category killer.
Yeah, so you know, the first version of that is going to be available to our early adopters in February, and then you know we're aiming for March or April to release version one of that to the world. And it's a super complex problem, and we've solved it. You know, we're looking at code right now, and sort of we're playing with the product right now, and we've solved this issue, but we had to build out an integrations team. I think a lot of times when people build marketing software, they kind of just throw, you know, they'll have a developer pick it up. And there's a big difference between that and creating an entire integrations infrastructure from the ground up that's architected for literally hundreds of integrations and that's created for third parties to write integrations with you. So like right now, people come to us and they're like, will you write an integration with product X, product Y, or product Z? And because of the architecture, like we have to write that integration ourselves. Like no one can write that integration for us. And what should be available in March or April is like anyone who wants Lead Pages or Center to integrate with them can literally write their own integration with us, regardless of whether we're sending data to them or they're sending data to us. They can write their own integration. So, you know, we want to kind of democratize access to our integrations platform.
Like you did with the marketplace for your templates.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, clever. I guess you're repeating what works. Clay, amazing. I know I've kept you on the line a long time. Just in closing now, firstly, thank you. Great job.
Yeah,
it's great
thank
to
you.
See Lead Pages soaring to the upper echelons, and I'm sure you're not even close to where it's going. What do you think I should have asked you that I may have overlooked?
Oh man, that's a great question. I really can't think of much. I think maybe you were getting at it there when you said like kind of, you know, when the stakes get higher and the pressure gets larger, you know, kind of who do you turn to? I think you were about to ask that, or you know, or what do you turn to? And so I think there's sort of the informational component, but I think at the end of the day, meditation has really saved my life. And I'm not about to get on like some sort of religious thing here. I'm just saying like 15 minutes of meditating a day is something I wish I would have started doing much, much earlier in life. And I think it's made me a better husband. I think it's made me a better coworker. I think it's made me a better leader. And, you know, it doesn't do what everyone expects it to do, but it kind of just gives you that, you know, a few milliseconds between saying something really stupid and, you know, being like, yeah, maybe I shouldn't say that dumb thing, you know?
You know what? It's really, I'm not surprised you said it. It's a common characteristic of people with high pressure. I got a lot from walking the dog around the block and listening to those brainwave entrainment things a decade ago. But these days it's surfing for me. And only yesterday I ordered Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind on Kindle. I'm right up that alley, and I think it's a good place to be.
Awesome. Yeah.
I think even Steve Jobs was into some of that stuff too.
I bet. It's, you got to have something or hard drugs to make
sure. And we're certainly not endorsing that, kids. Okay. Clay, thanks so much. I love catching up. I hope you can keep doing this for the next few years, because it's just fascinating as an observer to go on this ride. And thank you so much for sharing.
I always enjoy talking with you. It's been fun to have these conversations along the way. And so, thanks for the opportunity.
Discover how to build your business
super fast.
Check out superfastbusiness.com. Thank you.